Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Under our system of government, public agencies are not allowed to engage in the kind of advertising that promotes private business. As a result, we generally don't know very much about them, what they really do, and how effectively they do it. Lack of knowledge is not the best basis for informed judgment, what the founders expected of citizens. The same is true of the individuals who head government agencies. Who are they? What kind of people? Take Montana's Department of Public Health and Human Services. It's our largest state agency, employing some 3,100 people. Richard Opper is its director, but few of us know his name or what he thinks. We're about to find out. Richard, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Brian, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me to your show.
Let's start with talking about the department. I said it was the biggest in state government. What does it do? What are its main divisions?
Brian, we are the Department of Public Health and Human Services. So we really serve two primary functions. On the public health side, we have a lot of data to evaluate the health metrics of certain populations in the state, the young folks, old folks, rural, urban, comparing the populations, American Indian populations versus our non-Indian populations. So we can determine what areas of public health really need to be improved. And that section of the agency has developed a state health improvement plan that has a lot of very specific objectives about how we, over time, can improve and measure the improvement in the overall health of the population.
I like to think I know something, but I didn't know that. You say metrics about different populations. Can you give me an example of what that looks like, the kind of thing that comes across your desk and drives policy?
I'll give you a couple of short examples here. One example is Montana, compared to other states in the country, has a very high population of pregnant women who smoke. I think we are close to 20% of women in Montana, the Medicaid population of women whose births are paid for by our Medicaid dollars.
Low-income insurance. Okay.
And that's about 40% of the births statewide.
Wow.
20% of the women on Medicaid who are pregnant smoke. That's too high. It leads to much worse outcomes for both mother and babies. That's one of the things that came out when we collected statistics about that. That's higher than other surrounding states.
All right. Big problem. Than national average. What do you do about it?
It is a big problem. Educational program, subsidize smoking cessation, drugs, and educational opportunities that we have with that population.
That's highly interesting to me. Now, you have what I'll call an intervention program, counseling, and then prescriptions to help people get off smoking. Mm-hmm. How do you measure success?
We collect a lot of data in our public health section. I honestly think that more of my department's decisions need to be data-driven because the data really determines the success of our programs, and it determines the needs first for intervention and then determines the success of the program or the failure of the program so we can make adjustments. In terms of the impacts, we can measure the changes over time that are really a result of some of the interventions that we do.
So in relation to that, then, how do you close the loop? You're gathering data. What's the timeline structure for making decisions and saying, gee, it was a great idea, it didn't work, or it's a great idea and it's working?
This ties back to the state health improvement plan that the public health portion of my agency developed with a lot of input from people around the state. That's a relatively new program that's in place, and there are a lot of activities associated with it that are designed to improve some of these statistics that we have, like smoking in pregnant women. So we will come back and do the follow-up measurements after we put some programs, more programs in place to determine their effectiveness.
Okay, let me just see if I hear this right. You've got a program that's data-driven, whose mission is to design appropriate interventions and affect the health of target populations of Montanans over time?
That's correct. And if I could take the liberty of restating the obvious here, healthier children have better health outcomes in the future, of course, and healthier young people make better students. They participate better in school. Healthier adults are much more productive in the workforce. Healthier, older populations have a much more satisfying retirement. So,
and it costs the taxpayers less in terms of medical care, potentially.
Far, far less.
And roughly how many people in your department work on the public health side of your services?
It's actually a pretty small percentage. We only have a little over 200 people in our public health division.
Less than 10%.
Less than 10%.
Tell us about the other side.
The other side is the human services side. And their work is extremely varied. Essentially, Brian, we are the safety net for people who have very specific needs and very big, very large needs in their lives. They're not making it financially. There are children who are suffering abuse or neglect, or elders who are suffering abuse and neglect. People need the TANF assistance. TANF is what used to be considered welfare. And it's a time-limited program now, but it's cash assistance to them.
Temporary assistance to needy families.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's a federal program. You administer it in your department?
That's right. And we administer several programs that provide direct assistance to families in need. The TANF program, Temporary Aid to Needy Families, is one. We have what used to be called food stamps, which is now SNAP. It's called SNAP.
Supplementary Nutrition Assistance Program.
That provides money to families for supplementing their food budget.
How many people are we talking about? Do you have, in terms of, if we take a population of 900,000 to a million people in the state of Montana, do you have rough numbers about how many qualify for TANF or SNAP, or how many people you serve?
In Montana, we've got roughly 7,000 people who receive TANF benefits. And in terms of the SNAP benefits, which are these supplementing the food budget,
right,
we have about 124,000, 125,000 people at any given time.
That's obviously a very high number compared to the population of 900,000 to a million. And again, there are income requirements for qualifying for SNAP, correct?
Yes, there are. We also have a huge federal program that's administered by my department, which is the whole Medicaid program.
Lower income that qualify under federal standards.
Yes, but there are the eligibility requirements are very complicated. You have to meet certain requirements to be able to qualify for this federal insurance program for health insurance coverage. And you have to be age, blind, or disabled, for example. The poorest of the poor people in Montana in terms of annual income right now very often do not benefit from this program and do not have access to the healthcare system.
I don't understand. If you tell me, not questioning what you're saying, I just don't get it. If it's designed for low-income people, you're saying the poorest of the poor sometimes don't qualify because of the eligibility requirements?
That's correct. And that was really true in every state in the country, even though state programs vary from one state to another, how they administer it. We have to get approval for programs by the federal government, but we can design our own programs. Now, generally, what was supposed to fill that hole was going to be the Affordable Care Act, which was going to require that Medicaid be extended to people that have incomes from 0 to 100% of the federal poverty level, for example.
All right.
The one aspect of the Affordable Care Act that was really substantially revised by the U.S. Supreme Court was the requirement that states provide Medicaid eligibility for the poorest of the poor. They left that to individual states to determine.
Because of the complexity of this, with your approval, we'd like to do at least one show, maybe two shows, a follow-up on TANF, SNAP, and maybe Medicaid.
That would be great.
I just think there are complicated issues that affect a lot of our citizens, and they're not well understood. You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Richard Opper, Director of Montana's Department of Public Health and Human Services. With that overview, let's go back to where I usually start a show. Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Brian, I grew up in Oklahoma. I don't often admit this in public, but
man that had great influence on my life was a self-described Okie, no high school education, truck driver, taught me how to hunt squirrels as a child, and I regard him with great fondness and affection after all these years.
There's some good people in Oklahoma.
He was one.
So I also went to high school. I got my high school education in Oklahoma. My college degree was from Oklahoma State University.
In what?
It was in environmental / agricultural sciences.
And when would you have graduated? What period are we talking about?
That was in 1974.
Pretty socially active, environmentally active time, Endangered Species Act, a lot of legislation passed during that period of time. Did that affect you in terms of your thoughts?
We were the quiet rock in the pool around which the river rushes. It was
meaning you or your fellow students?
No, my fellow students. Now, I was frustrated by the isolation. I did a lot of traveling around the country when, honestly, I should have been in school.
What did you learn traveling around the country?
Well, I learned that of the 50 states that I've now seen, I landed in by far the best one.
Which was?
It's Montana.
I see. Okay. So you ended up here, and what struck you about it?
Well, I knew from the moment I crossed the border that I was going to spend the bulk of my life in this state. I just fell in love with it. I just connected with the landscape in a way that I never had with any other location. Plus, in my travels, I met people who were from Montana, and they displayed a trait that seemed very foreign to me coming from Oklahoma. They were proud of where they came from. And I had to see this place, and I did. I fell in love with it. I decided I wanted to make this my home, my permanent home, and I've been here since 1974. I moved here right after college.
Did you go on to graduate school?
I did. I got a degree in environmental sciences from Montana State University back in, I think, 1979.
Before we discuss your post-college career, let me just ask you, growing up between the time you were a kid and the time you went off to college, what would you say were your central values, the things that would stick with you today?
I loved the land, and I would say environmental issues are what drove me in the early days. I organized the very first Earth Day celebration in 1970 when I was a senior in high school for my school. I organized a walk to school day, for example, and we had lots of press, and walking was a foreign concept in the state of Oklahoma. I greatly miscalculated. I ended up having to hitchhike to school rather than walk the whole way, but I had the wisdom to be dropped off a block away so I could pretend to be walking the rest of the way. But it was a successful event.
What led to that interest? In your background, Oklahoma tends to be a rural state. I don't know if you grew up urban or rural, but what led to that love of the land?
That's a very good question, Brian. I think maybe it was in reaction to my parents. I used to jokingly and lovingly say about my father that he was so outdoorsy. I once actually saw him roll the windows down in his car. So it might have been partly a reaction to that, but over time it grew into such a deep core value that it's really never left me.
So after college, tell us about your first job, first serious job.
First serious job was in Bozeman, associated with the university, and I worked on a project to help reclaim mined lands, coal mine lands. And it was a reclamation research unit associated with the university. And that was back in the days when there were plans drawn to strip mine, essentially, all of eastern Montana. And they really didn't have the knowledge base to do adequate reclamation at the time. And so this group did a lot of research as to how to improve reclamation techniques after lands had been mined.
Reclamation is a word I think all of us have heard. I would have trouble describing it in terms of, let's say, coal strip mining. What does it mean? How does it function? What's it look like?
Well, I think we all know mining does produce scars on the landscape, and particularly strip mining because you have to remove so much material before you get to the coal seam. Reclamation is restoring the land to sustained productivity that is at least equal to what it had prior to the mining.
So that would involve, obviously, replacing soil for topsoil, just for basics?
Yes, you have to retain the topsoil and the subsoil, and you have to make sure you test the overburden so that it's not toxic, and you have to replace it in the proper order, and you have to decide how long you need to put artificial inputs into the landscape, like grazing or fertilizer or water.
I'm going to ask you for a short answer to a complicated question. Overall, how well do we do it on a scale of 1 to 10, reclaiming now? This is a long time later. Presumably, we've learned something along the way.
Well, in one of my more recent jobs, I got to see a lot of the areas that have been reclaimed. And honestly, I think they do a marvelous job on the reclamation now. It's taken a while, but it's good.
I have a cheat sheet here. It's your resume. And it says Southern Pueblos Governor's Council, 1986 to 88. What was that experience about?
Well, first of all, I can't verify the accuracy of the resume there since I am a bit of a fiction writer. But but that particular job, Brian, was helping the Indian Pueblos in New Mexico do mostly natural resource planning so they could take advantage of the resources they had, the considerable resources, whether it was grazing, cattle production, agriculture, mining, and do it in a sustainable fashion. And I think the wonderful thing about that job for me was it was the first time that professionally I'd had a chance to connect very directly with the American Indian population. And I learned a lot about their culture through that. Not that there is one single culture that categorizes all of our American Indian population. Each of the Pueblos themselves had different cultures, and they're very different than the Great Plains Indians.
Was it involved Navajo, Zuni?
Didn't work with the Navajos, did work with Zuni a little bit, worked with Isleta. There were about eight different Pueblos that were in our coalition.
Let me ask you something. Just in terms of most of us don't have that experience. Coming from Anglo culture, you're exposed to some tribal people in a fairly sustained way. What did you learn? If you were to boil it down, what did you learn that you didn't know that still is, you'd say, meaningful to you?
One learning is that they are first and foremost humans. Like the rest of us, they seek to be heard. They seek to be respected. They seek to be understood. And I don't think historically the non-Indian population in this country has afforded those to our Native American population as well as it should have. So it is a population with whom it is particularly important to listen.
This is Home Ground, and you're listening to Brian Kahn. We're talking with Richard Opper, Director of Montana's Department of Public Health and Human Services. Next is Northern Lights Institute, based in Missoula. You were the director. What was that about?
That was a nonprofit organization that really focused on a couple of different things. One is it wanted to give voice to people who wrote about the land and people's connection with the land throughout the Intermountain West. The other thing we did in that organization was we really mediated a lot of environmental disputes between organizations.
For example?
For example, we noticed, among other things, that there were a lot of competing factions in the Missouri River Basin, each of whom had very different ideas about how the plumbing system that is the Missouri River should be managed. The upstream states had a very different vision about how the river should be managed than the downstream states.
Sure.
The states had a different vision of how the river should be managed than the reservations, the American Indian folks in the basin.
Those are major interests. How does Northern Lights have any influence to decide or help people mediate that kind of serious dispute?
Isn't that always the question in the nonprofit world, how you can influence outcomes when you have no authority or responsibility? You do that by bringing the parties together and trying to facilitate a meaningful conversation so that you outline the issues and you brainstorm on solutions.
How'd it work?
Unfortunately, a little too well, because apparently they liked the work well enough that there was a nonprofit Missouri River Basin Association that right after that hired me as their director.
I noticed that. So that suggests that Key Interests found the issue worth discussing and had confidence that you could facilitate that discussion over time.
They did, and I held that job for about 14 years. And the difficult part, I think you understand all the politics associated with water.
They just about are everything in the West because it's scarce, so it's tough stuff.
It is scarce. And the major conflicts were between the upstream states that were interested in reservoir-based recreation, which was a huge economic boon for them, and the downstream interests that counted on the Missouri River for drinking water, cooling water for their power plants, navigation, river-based navigation, that kind of thing. So there were very competing interests among the states. And then we had endangered species issues, which really drove a lot of the discussions.
It'd be worth another show, but since we don't have another show, after 15 or 14 years, anything change in that dynamic? Are they still talking? Did they solve some problems? Or are there storage points? What's the deal?
We had our successes. We were able to agree on management plans. We were able to agree in times of drought and in times of flood about the best compromises we could make and present those plans to the federal government that actually had its hands on the spigots of these dams.
Mm-hmm.
But the conflict still exists and will always exist.
What did you learn from that process, again, that you didn't know going in? What's the takeaway there?
I think what I learned primarily is the same thing I learned in my first exposure to the American Indian population professionally, is that people need to be heard. They need to know that their position is understood by people, and they need an opportunity and a forum to express their voice. And if decisions are made that run contrary to their interest, it's certainly important for them to know why those decisions were made.
Let me ask you this on that point. My experience has been that there's a lot of emotion behind disagreements, particularly ones of importance. And in the process of being heard, if the other side's listening and you can set it up in a way that's non-adversarial, people open up and begin to be more receptive to the merits, some merits on the other side, and it creates a new zone of possible agreement that wasn't there in the beginning. Is that your experience or not?
That's absolutely our experience. And really the best thing we did when it came to resolving disputes was to sponsor conferences where we brought factions together that did not see eye to eye. And we forced the people to basically sit at the same table, break out in small groups, and really have a discussion. And if necessary, we supply the alcohol. Ultimately, it seemed to work out pretty
yes,
well.
Yes, I was going to – it rang a bell. I found that in certain situations, a little beer helps people relax. And again, to me, I would say open up to the humanness of the person that they've categorized in their mind as an opponent. And that's kind of like a breakthrough.
Much harder to shoot at somebody whose face you recognize and whose children you know the names of.
In January 2005, you became director of the Montana Department of Environmental Quality. What do they do in a nutshell?
They do a lot of work, too. They're a pretty small agency number-wise, but they touch a lot of the citizens in the state. They do the environmental permitting. If you want to build a power plant, if you want to build a subdivision, you need a permit for discharging water, whatever. You have to go through the environmental the Department of Environmental Quality to get your environmental permit to do
so.
All
right. And what do you bring to that table? In other words, here you have this, I'll call it mediative background, cross-cultural diversity. You're walking into an environment, I'm going to say a lightning rod, because there's chronic polarized arguments between industry and environmental conservation, and you're sort of the agency that decides the permits. Real easy job, I suspect.
No controversy whatsoever about that.
Yeah, everybody loves you. So what do you bring to it in terms of your tenure, would you say, looking back?
My approach was always the same as when I worked in the nonprofit world. I really wanted to bring people together to see if we could craft solutions. I always try to keep the big picture in mind and come up with solutions that worked pretty well for people. Now, the difference between my job there at the Department of Environmental Quality and my work with nonprofits is ultimately, I got to make the decisions. So I really got to make the hard calls. And the job is fairly easy in some ways because you follow the laws and the science.
Okay.
That sounds good, but the laws and the science have a lot of gray area.
Let me ask you just an overview question, because there's this ongoing battle between, quote, protecting the environment and, quote, a viable, vibrant economy, particularly in natural resources. What do you say about the fight?
Number one, it's nothing new. If you read transcripts of hearings from the 1970s, it sounds as if it could have happened today. So the two aren't incompatible. To have a healthy economy, you need a healthy environment.
So you've had a long and in-depth career in natural resources issues, environmental mediation. How the shift to public health? Why?
It's been a significant shift, and I was really surprised and honored when the governor asked me to head this department. So I went from issuing permits for gravel pits, for example, to making decisions and running an agency that has a very direct impact on people's lives. And certainly the issues I deal with are a lot more emotional. And I see my job, Brian, is doing everything I can to try to help us function more effectively so that we can deliver our services to people who need them. More simply, I want our work to be more understandable, and I want it to be easier for people to access the services we provide. And again, Brian, just kind of to wrap this up, I fell in love with this state in 1974 when I first saw it. And looking back over my time here, I feel so fortunate, so blessed, because I have been asked to do two things for state government. One is to protect Montana's incredible environment, and the other is to provide services to the incredible people we have in this state. That's really quite an honor, and I just feel very, very lucky, and I have to pinch myself every day to realize the honor I've been given. So as tough as the jobs are, I've always been nothing but grateful for the opportunities.
Richard Opper, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
It's been my pleasure, and it's gone all too quickly.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.